From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Welcome to The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Let's talk wire, Joel.
All right.
Antenna wire. I mean, can I just take any old wire and make an antenna out of it? I know that I can, but not necessarily a good antenna. Does it matter?
Well, there are some things that matter in with different parts of the process. But fundamentally, if you put RF current in a conductor, it will radiate.
Yes.
Now, there's a problem of getting the RF into the conductor, which is sort of a different question. We won't address that
particularly.
But assuming you can get the wire there, which implies things about matching and transmission line loss and all kinds of things, almost any kind of wire can work just fine. I mean, people in the 50s, it was very popular to have invisible antennas made out of very fine enameled wire from audio transformers strung between
trees.
Oh,
absolutely. Yes.
And the argument was, well, yeah, every time a bird tries to land on it, it'll break, but you get miles of it out of an audio transformer, so you just put it up again. And people, you know, it was kind of an invisible antenna. That was an article in QST. So I think if you search on invisible, you may actually find that. The first issue is the material of the antenna wire. Now, most antenna wire is either copper or aluminum. In fact, mostly copper, but aluminum will also work. And they are highly conductive. You know, it could be somewhat more conductive if they were gold, but you don't see that a lot.
Oh, well, I have a dipole made out of gold.
Yeah, that's the 160
gold
meter.
Gold wire, yes.
But copper or aluminum are good choices because they have high conductivity. Now, if any reduction in conductivity reduces the amount of current you get from the signal you put into it, so you get less radiation. Steel is not a good choice for wire, and some people try to use fence wire and things that are not particularly good because they're steel, and steel has both has higher resistivity, but it also has an impedance due to the magnetic properties, which reduce its likelihood to take as much current. Stainless steel does not share that quite as much, although it's not as good as copper or aluminum, but it has some mechanical properties that make it very useful for mobile whips, for example. If you try to make a mobile whip out of copper, it would not stay vertical very long. Now, there's a kind of a hybrid, which is copper-clad steel, which acts like copper as long as the copper is thick enough so that the RF is entirely within the copper. This is kind of tricky. This is a skin effect issue.
Is that what they call copper weld, or is that something else?
Copper weld is a brand name for copper-plated steel wire.
Oh, okay.
And it has, in a way, the best of both worlds because the steel makes it very strong and less likely to break. I use it, and I've had it hold up trees that tried to break. I mean, it's really good stuff. But, the downside is it's harder to work with and so forth, so it's a little bit fussier to deal with. But the key is that the plating has to be thick enough for the RF to stay in the plating out at the edge of the wire. You want it to be 1 to 2 skin depths deep, and the skin depth decreases from about 65 micrometers, which is not very thick, at 1 megahertz, to 0.021 micrometers at 10 megahertz. So the copper doesn't have to be very thick to work well, but it has to be there. And of course, if it corrodes or something and disappears, then you're down to steel, and that's not so good. But otherwise, copper clad can work very well. And if you think about it, beams, for example, are made out of tubing because even if it were solid aluminum, nothing would flow in the middle because of the skin effect, which would push everything out to the edges of the conductor. Now, the size of the wire, in my opinion, is largely a mechanical issue. The wire should be strong enough to hold up a bird or two or 10. I've had quite a few sitting on my antennas. As with any conductor, current in the antenna wire will result in heating, and that is the same as loss, because any radiation that occurs as heat will not be radiated as RF. But that's not usually a big issue. If we talk about the maximum current in a half-wave dipole, we have it at the feed point where we connect the transmission line, and it's just equal by Ohm's law to the square root of the power over the resistance. So for a 50-ohm dipole fed by 100 watts, we have 1.4 amps during key down. That's not a lot of current if you think about your home wiring.
No.
If we take it up to 1,500 watts, we're up to 5.5 amps. Now, that's at the modulation peak or during key down.
Yes.
And typically during modulation, not talking about RTDY or something, but we're typically running 25 to 35%, and that's what the factor that it relates to heating. Now, keep in mind that your number 14 wire in your house can handle 15 amperes all day long, while, you know, we're running a maximum of a third of that at legal power with a 50-watt system, or 1,500-watt system. Now, of course, the house wire has, the skin depth is deeper, so there's more surface area the current's flowing through, but still, in terms of the thermal effects, the whole wire can act as a thermal sink, so it gives you an idea. So, you know, number 14 wire is plenty good enough for any kinds of current in a typical antenna. Now, that changes somewhat if you go to something like a very highly loaded shortened antenna, which has a much lower impedance and will have higher current. So, you know, there's special cases where you need to look a little more closely at the amount of current that you'll have and understand what it is and how to deal with it. And resistance does introduce loss, and the loss can be higher with lower impedance systems, as we just discussed. But it's really not a problem for the usual center-fed dipole or other, even a Yagi. And if we just take some examples, reducing the wire size from number 14 to number 22, which is probably as small as the bird could handle,
yes,
it results in a reduction in signal strength of just 0.1 decibels.
I could hear that.
Yeah, just barely. The bird would not even hear that. Going the other direction, going from number 14 to number 6, which is probably as big a wire as you'd want to haul up, provides an additional 0.04 decibel of signal strength.
Well, yeah. that might make the difference in working that DX pile up, you know.
Yes, I guess it could. Just barely, but maybe you need something else going for you if that's how close you are. The differences in wire size is not very significant. The other thing people think about is, well, thicker antennas have higher bandwidth, which is true, and they end up being a little bit shorter, which can be important. But the differences within wire sizes is not significant. To get the advantage of that, you either have to go to multiple wires, as in a cage dipole, or something like a Yagi made out of tubing, which will have a wider bandwidth than a wire dipole would have. At least a single element tubing dipole will have wider bandwidth than a wire dipole. By the time you make it into a Yagi, the bandwidth starts going down again for other reasons, but that's beyond the discussion of what the wire is all about. Now, there's another choice here that's between stranded and solid wire.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
And I used to believe that they were electrically equivalent, and I think that they are when the wire is new. But recently, it has been determined that our old favorite for ground straps, which was copper braid, actually, if it's in the weather, has much higher impedance as the wire corrodes. Because I think the thing is, stranded wire acts like solid wire if the strands are in good contact with each other. But once you start getting corrosion and the strands no longer make contact with each other, now you have a slightly different thing with coils of wire interconnected and intertwined and wrapping around. And I don't think it works quite as well. I have no proof of this. That's just my assumption based on measurements about copper strap, which share the same problem. My solution to that is to use stranded wire with insulation on it, with the insulation keeping it from getting corroded. It has some other benefits, too. For one thing, it's less visible. If you have black insulated wire in the air, it reflects light much less so than does shiny new copper.
I can attest to that. Yeah. That's what I use. I use black insulated stranded wire. Yeah. Yes.
So my favorite, actually, is stranded copper weld, insulated stranded copper weld wire. The advantages of that is it doesn't break. It has been known to hold trees up. Because it's stranded, it's more flexible. And I think this is true of all stranded wire. It's my belief that it's less subject to metal fatigue than solid wire. And that's also true in my experience for things like window line. If the window line is supported along its length so that it can't move very much, then I think solid wire is fine. Same with open wire line. If it, on the other hand, is hanging there, free to move in the wind, in my experience, it tends to break more quickly, particularly at the ends, but could break anywhere if it is solid rather than stranded. So I like stranded wire if it's not supported, which most dipoles are.
I have a question, Joel, but let's wait and hear from DX Engineering and we'll be right back.
Okay, I'll be right here.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hands ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. And here's my question for you. You were talking about windowed line, your typical 450-ohm windowed line.
Okay.
Now, without mentioning manufacturers, you know that there are devices out there that claim to hold the line in place at the center, at the feed point of a dipole, to keep that windowed line from flexing and breaking. Are those worthwhile or not, do you think?
Well, I've used some of those successfully. I think the big thing is to devise a strategy, and there can be many ways to do this. In my experience, having a soldered connection in the line that has mechanical stress to it, like where the dipole leaves the insulator at the center, is asking for a break as the copper, the flexible copper, enters the stiff solder. That's where it seems to break in my experience. So what I try to do is I try to arrange it in such a way that the stress is always on just the stranded part or just the antenna wire itself, and then the connections are out of the stress path. Now, that's very easy to do with one of those insulators, but it's not a given because you can actually, depending on how you make the connections, you can actually lose that benefit. So I think it's important to be able to do a number of things. One is to keep any stress from the connections, and the insulators that clamp the wire in some way, the window line, or in the same thing is true of coax, can avoid having strain on the connections themselves, which you want to do, I think, or the connectors. I mean, there's nothing worse than having it, looking up and seeing your coax connector is still connected to the antenna, but the coax is pulled out from it.
Oh, yes, and that has happened to me.
Yes, indeed. Yes. So you want it, you know, you want to remove stress, and removing stress on the antenna will remove stress on you.
Yes.
When you wonder why you aren't getting out. You know, I think they can be helpful, and I've used them, and I've been happy with them.
And you had something else you wanted.
Yeah, I wanted to mention, we talked about insulating wire, and it's important to note that insulation around wire reduces the velocity of the electrical signal as it's going down the wire before it radiates, and that has the effect of making the wire act like it's actually longer. And typically, depending on the thickness of the insulation and the type of insulation it is, the dielectric constant, an insulated wire antenna needs to be 1% to 2% shorter than a bare wire antenna, all other things being equal. There are other factors that may be more important. Height above ground and other things that are around can make a big difference too. But it just, you know, once you have everything figured out, if you're using insulated wire, make sure that you take that into account, or don't be surprised to find the antenna is tuned to a lower frequency than you expect. This is not a bad thing. The antenna works just as well. And for some people, taking up a little less space means it fits when it might not have otherwise. But just be aware that that's the case.
And you were talking earlier, in fact, right at the beginning of the podcast, about people that are using or have used what they used to call, maybe they still call it, magnet wire, the really, really thin gauge wire for antennas,
right,
in stealth installations. So you're saying, unless I'm misinterpreting, that despite that wire being almost the thickness of a human hair, that performance-wise, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference.
No, it's a very small amount of difference. We had a number, I don't know what number wire that is, but as I said before, going from number 14, which is probably the most commonly used antenna wire, down to number 22 in a typical antenna, I forget what band this was on, but it had a reduction in 0.1 decibel. Now, that's certainly a reduction, but it's not usually noticeable, and compared to the reduction of not being able to put the antenna up, if somebody can see it, it's much better to have the antenna than to not have the antenna.
Well, that's certainly a fair trade-off, I would say.
Yes.
Okay. Are you prepared for a question?
I am.
And this one kind of concerns wire, after a fashion. Rob, KE5YOW, asks, my question concerns running wiring through a vehicle firewall. My 2007 Honda Pilot has a hole in the firewall that is filled with a rubber plug. I've seen that myself. Will I have any problems running both the antenna feeding coax of my 50-watt VHF transceiver and the power wires through the same hole? What say you?
I not at all, as far as I can tell. Now, I've never actually done that, so I have to be a little bit careful with what I say, but I think it makes perfect sense to do that. And first of all, let me say you're very fortunate to have such a plug. I have had cars with similar access ports, and it makes equipment installation much easier. Because basically, batteries are almost always in the front of the car, and radios tend to be towards the rear someplace. Now, in my case, my radio is usually in the trunk, and the control head is in the driver's compartment, and the battery's in the front. So I don't have the problem of running the power and the coax in the same through the same hole. But I can't imagine that there would be a problem with that. Assuming everything is set up properly, the coax, you don't have common mode current running on the coax and so forth, but it should be just fine. The only problem with that is to be very careful about how you do it. If you take the plug out and the wires, particularly the power wires, run right through a bare metal hole, my concern is that they would get chafed and short out. And then you've got a real problem on your hands if you go directly to the battery and do not have it fused, because what will happen is you'll get a short and you could have briefly hundreds of amperes or whatever the limit, whatever the current is limited by the resistance of 6 feet of wire from the battery to the chassis. And you put that on your car battery, good chance your car battery will explode, or that would be if you're lucky. If you're not lucky, the car battery won't explode and it'll keep delivering power until you start a fire in there. You know, that's not a good thing to have happen, especially if you're on the road at high speed and all of a sudden your car is on fire. This is not a good thing.
Somebody will come by and say, "You're on fire." You'll think it's because you're handsome or your car is...
yes.
Yeah. No, really, you're on fire.
Indeed, because, by the way, I've done that. You don't even notice necessarily because the smoke tends to go out the back just because of the airspeed. But anyway, so it's a very dangerous situation anytime you have a raw edge hole. So my recommendation is either, if you can use the plug that's there and just open up part of it. I had a car, I guess an old Volvo station wagon, that had a plug like that and had a bunch of little protrusions of different diameter. And I could just clip one of those off and run wires through it, easy to seal up with a little tape, and kept me separated from the body. Now, the corollary of that is no matter how you do it, you want to have, if you run directly to the battery, you want to have a fuse right at the battery. So that no matter what happens in the engine compartment by you or the car vibration or some mechanic not knowing what's going on, you don't end up with a short that's directly tied to the battery that will cause a major problem. So I always have a fuse within 2 inches of the battery terminal. And that way, if something does happen, either an accident or an incompetent behavior on the part of somebody, you will not destroy anything except a fuse, which is much easier to replace than a car or a person.
Now, will you fuse both the positive and the negative lead?
Generally, what I do is I just fuse the positive lead at the battery because that's what I'm concerned about is the battery shorting to the car. Now, most manufacturers provide fuses, which I also leave in the circuit, back at the radio or near the radio in the power cable that comes with the radio. They provide one of each, and that's kind of designed to protect the radio. The first one by the battery is designed to protect the car and the driver from disaster. The one back at the radio is designed to protect the radio from disaster. And the reason for the negative fuse is, think about how your car is wired. There's a large strap going from the engine itself to the body, sometimes from the negative terminal of the battery to the frame of the car. That carries the current of everything, but including the starter motor when it pulls, which pulls a lot of current. Now, that cable can come loose because of vibration or corrosion. I've seen them corrode right off. And interestingly, of course, if the car is running, it'll keep running because when it's running, the current is not that high through that strap. It'll find some other way to get back. But if you try to start it, it probably won't start. But it'll try to start, and the current from the starter motor will try to return through any other path. Now, if one of the paths is through the negative lead of the power system, back to the radio, and then from the ground of the radio to the shield of the coax, to the fender that the antenna is connected to, that you've tied the shield to, all of that current will try to complete through wiring within your radio because it doesn't go directly from the power negative to the antenna coax. It goes through your printed circuit board in the radio.
Now, let me guess. That is probably not a good thing.
That is not a good thing because what you'll do is instead of a fuse blowing, you'll blow traces on your printed circuit board.
Oh, big time.
Big
yes.
time. Now, this is an unlikely event, but I have actually seen it happen. In my undergraduate days, I used to do two-way radio repair for trucks and things like that, boats and all kinds of stuff. But I've actually seen trucks that had that problem, that the ground strap had come off. I think that's the reason for the negative, the fuse and the negative lead. Yeah, one other thing to think about with this rubber plug, if your rubber plug is not capable of being adapted to take the wire through it, if you can find a grommet that goes around the wire and will fit in the hole, that's another solution to keep it from chafing against it. The other thing you want to worry about is you either before or after you find your clutch foot wet on a rainy day, you want to caulk carefully any passages you take through the firewall, because you not only have a firewall, it's also a water wall, and it keeps the water out of your passenger compartment, and it'll just run down your pants leg, fill up your sock and your shoe. So make sure you do that also.
Okay. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.